From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Back now to our top story today, Syria under siege. As a crackdown by the Assad regime only gets worse.
Government troops bombarded the rebellious city of Homs again.
The slaughter continues. The dictator Bashar al-Assad seems out to destroy all opposition.
The situation in Syria is beyond dire. Nearly 1 year into the uprising there, with the death toll estimated to exceed 5,000 souls, mostly civilians, the regime of President Bashar al-Assad shows no signs of backing down. Last week, vetoes by China and Russia scuttled a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for Assad to step down. And since then, activists and residents have reported hundreds more deaths concentrated in the besieged city of Homs. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said we are witnessing, quote, appalling brutality in Homs. But in reality, tight restrictions on media in Syria are making it difficult for the world community to witness anything there at all. This is why, perhaps more so than any other conflict during the Arab Spring, social media have played a crucial role in getting information out of the country.
Dead bodies, all in the hospital. Look, this is all dead bodies. We're not animals, we're human beings, we're asking for help.
But in this new media order, some old media questions linger. In a situation as horrific as Syria's, how do you walk the line between conveying the immensity of the brutality without traumatizing the audience? Joining me now are two influential tweeters who have been curating news throughout the Arab Spring on their respective Twitter feeds. Andy Carvin is a senior strategist at NPR. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Neil Mann is digital news editor at Sky News. Hello, Neil.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Twitter, as we've discussed many times on this program, has increasingly been a channel for breaking news. In Syria, social media, I gather, is virtually the only game in town?
I think it is to an extent. It's worth noting that obviously we've had teams in there, the BBC have had teams in there, and other major news organizations have managed to get in there, but they can only go in for a certain period of time. And for the likes of me and Andy, social media has really filled a gap which constant presence there has left.
Andy, tell me what kind of stuff you've been including in your feed.
I've been observing a number of streams that regularly are activated from Homs. I am in conversations with people via Skype and email. I monitor about half a dozen different YouTube channels as well as Facebook pages. And then there are these scores of people on Twitter who have become fairly reliable sources as well. So it's basically this lattice work of information that even just paying attention to one city, it's almost overwhelming at times given the amount of violence taking place there right now.
Now, I haven't asked you guys to join me to discuss a hypothetical. There was a video making its way around the web that captured the immense cruelty of the government's shelling of civilians in Homs. It depicts a young boy alive but grievously injured. Some ordnance had blown his lower jaw off, and it was very hard to look at.
That's probably one of the worst videos I've seen in the entire Arab Spring. I mean, it was truly harrowing, I think I described it at the time, and it was the first time I've really had to seriously think on whether I should actually put this video out to my following on Twitter. And it wasn't a video that I would ever be able to run on air on Sky News. It was just too graphic. And I felt that actually I had to make a personal editorial choice as to my Twitter feed. And it wasn't an easy one to take. I thought about it long and hard.
It was just too much, you thought, for your followers to bear?
There may be people who follow me who are not used to viewing videos like this in the same way that the likes of Andy or I am, due to the fact we're journalists.
Now, Andy, you performed approximately the same sort of calculus, and you came to a different decision.
I did tweet it because I thought it was important to give the link some context. I found out about it because a number of contacts from Syria and other people were sending it to me on Twitter. And the very first time I saw it, it had no context. And so, as bad as the video is, for me it was even worse because I was not prepared to see what was there. And so calculus was to share it with my followers and say in very blunt terms that this is footage of a boy whose jaw had been blown off. And I also said, it's not enough to call this graphic. I think it's an abomination. I don't use those words lightly. And my Twitter followers know that. And I heard back from a lot of Twitter followers. Some of them said, because of my description, they made the choice not to watch it. Others decided to watch it. But they all thanked me nonetheless for giving them an informed choice. We're in a different age now compared to back in the day when mass media was essentially considered family viewing. You would have the news on in the evening and the family would be there. The newspaper would be sitting on the table at breakfast. And so the possibility of accidentally exposing people to imagery they weren't prepared for was too great. And so discretion was the norm. But now that people have a choice to be on Twitter and follow my account and then making the informed choice of clicking that link, I think gives people enough of a firewall to make an informed decision.
The subject of this video clearly was a poster child for the Assad regime's extraordinary brutality against the civilian population. But he was also a child, a minor. And I'm going to just take a wild guess and say he didn't sign any releases, nor did his parents, to have his horrible injuries the talk of the internet.
I've seen people in the flesh who have been hit by ordnance, bullets, and are in a substantial amount of pain. And although they're being filmed by somebody, they may not necessarily actually want that video to go out. In this instance of this kid, that was obviously also playing on my mind, is actually this child is going through a lot of pain. And is it worth putting that out for other people to see when, say, for example, a description may do the job?
Did that enter your thinking, Andy?
As far as I was concerned, Pandora's box had already been opened. The video had been online for probably 4 or 5 hours by the time I saw it, and it was being discussed in a variety of circles on Twitter and on Facebook. This child at this point was still alive, and I wanted the world to see this because I know there are Twitter followers in Turkey and in Lebanon, some of whom have resources to respond to these situations. And in fact, within an hour or two of me tweeting it, I quickly heard from volunteers across the region who were mobilizing to get this kid out. They actually made arrangements for him to be smuggled across the border, and there was a reconstructive surgery team waiting for him in Lebanon. And it all happened because they saw the video being shared on Twitter. Unfortunately, the boy never stabilized, and he died before they could transport him. But the fact that people from multiple countries worked literally overnight to plan a rescue mission for this kid, I don't think would have happened if they hadn't seen the video themselves.
Another Pandora's box question. Now that this stuff is substantially in play in social media, do you think it's changed the thinking of mainstream media as to their standards for what constitutes too graphic?
The thing is that maybe we're not showing more graphic videos, but actually there's just more graphic videos out there. The amount of videos actually coming out of the Arab Spring is vast. It's like no conflict before it. These are almost being, you know, live video blogged effectively. For us, the same editorial standards remain, but there's just more videos out there and more newsworthy moments may be captured.
I think all you have to do is think of the death of Muammar Gaddafi. When Gaddafi was killed, there was suddenly an influx of videos of his last few hours. And some of it was pretty disturbing stuff, the kinds of things that normally you would never see on TV. I was really surprised not only were those clips being shown. At one point, I saw on Al Jazeera, they did a freeze frame of one of the shots after he died. And they said, we're going to leave this on screen in case you want to take a screenshot of it. And I thought, wow, how have we come to a point that not only are we sharing these things on mainstream media, that we're actually encouraging people to capture that moment of death. And I wouldn't be surprised if part of it does have to do with the fact that we've consumed so much video from these scenes over the last year.
An argument for journalists passing on the horrors of war is that it sensitizes outsiders to what is taking place. The opposite argument is that these images over time desensitize the outsiders as to what's taking place, that they just get used to it.
Absolutely. And I've noticed it on myself over the last year. There was a time last spring when I would receive a video of someone who had been shot or someone who was dying. I would stop everything I was doing and try to focus on what was going on. It seemed almost like a sacred act to honor a person that way, to give them the time and effort to observe their final moments. But fast forward 6 months into the revolution, I'd catch myself watching some of these videos while drinking coffee or listening to music on my headphones. And at some point, I practically had to hit myself and say, you know, what are you doing? You know, is this disrespectful sitting here just watching one video after another? And I started thinking of those typical cop shows on TV where detectives are saying sly things around the corpse below them, not even flinching about it. And it reminded me that I don't want to ever turn into that. I shared the video because I actually thought it would snap people out of their complacency, because we've seen so many videos of people protesting, so many videos of people just laying there in hospitals. But there was something about this image, about being able to look this boy in the eye and see the numbness. His soul was already beginning to disappear at that point. It seemed to me emblematic of what was happening in Homs, and I wanted to give people that opportunity to watch it if they chose.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Andy Carvin is a senior strategist at NPR. He tweets at A. Carvin. Neil Mann is digital news editor at Sky News in London. He tweets at Field Producer.
Coming up, how to cover campaigns when what you're covering isn't nearly as important as news outlets want it to be.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A few weeks ago, Dana Milbank, political columnist for The Washington Post, pinned his heart on his sleeve and wrote a very high-profile love letter to Newt Gingrich. In it, he seemed to articulate what a lot of campaign reporters have been feeling, but were perhaps too bashful to say. How do we love you, Newt Gingrich? Let us count the ways. You're the only thing saving us from a long spring of despair, the only person who can, by extending the presidential race, drive up our audience and bring us the revenues we so desperately need. All right, he was kidding. But Milbank was acknowledging the vested interest reporters have in prolonging the horse race. Dana, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Dana, do you know anybody on the campaign trail, and there are hundreds of you, who does not believe that Mitt Romney's nomination is a foregone conclusion?
You know, some people will say that they don't believe that Romney's nomination is certain. But still, if you woke any of my colleagues up in the middle of the night and said, who's going to win it, they will say Mitt Romney and then go back to sleep.
So let me read you the four-column headline above the fold in today's Washington Post, your newspaper.
Yes.
It says, Santorum moves to build on three-state sweep. An enthusiasm gap and a bumpy path for Romney. Resurgent candidate raises money, looks to the Midwest. One story says, quote, in position to contend for the Republican nomination.
You got to remember, Bob, that this is the same exact thing we in the media have been doing for the last year or so. We've had, what, seven or eight different front runners. So we're, in many cases, inventing races that don't exist. Now, Santorum did surprise Romney. Santorum is raising a lot of money off of this. The Romney folks are rattled about it. But if you step back, as I believe many of my colleagues have done and will continue to do, it's still hard to see a path to the nomination for anybody other than Mitt Romney. Now, goodness knows, reporters love a horse race. That's why we had frontrunner Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry and Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich two or three times. But if you look at the fundamentals, Mitt Romney was in a dominant position to start this, and he remains in a dominant position.
And that's why in your classically tongue-in-cheek Milbankian way, you penned a love letter to Newt Gingrich for behaving as if there really were some drama about what was going to happen.
Well, sure. When Newt Gingrich gets up there and says the media want him out of the race, I can say there is nothing further from the truth. And I'm sure the media are now delighted that Santorum seems to have come back from the dead. We like conflict, and we like to see these things dragged out as long as possible because it's good for viewership or listenership or readership, but it also makes our jobs much more enjoyable. You don't want to sit around and write for 5 months about the, you know, nuance of tax policy.
Now, you know, I know you were joking around in your piece, but what you were referring to is a genuine conflict of interest. If it is indeed in the media's interest to pump up every little development along the path to the nomination, is the audience being misled?
No, I don't think anybody is being misled. This is how the press works and how it has always worked. We emphasize conflict. You never see a story in the Washington Post or anywhere else about how many planes landed safely at Washington National Airport yesterday. The truth is that's not really what people are looking for either.
Fair enough, but I'm having trouble reconciling the first part of your answer, no, nobody's being misled, mm-hmm. with the second part, which gets to the kind of hype that you believe journalism is biased towards.
You know, look, I don't want to be in a position of defending everything that happens on cable news. I don't think anybody wants to be in that position. But certainly looking at the Washington Post, I think people who are reading what we're doing are seeing, yes, this is an exciting and unexpected development, but keep reading and you see, well, look, Romney is in a dominant position in terms of money raising. The fundamentals of the race haven't really changed at all. I mean, I think it's equivalent to writing about a big one-day rise or fall in the stock market, which we'll also make a big deal of, but a sensible reader would read into it more and realize that, yes, stocks go up and stocks go down, and ultimately the patterns are a lot more predictable.
Okay, but you know, I'm going to continue to hold your feet to the fire because, after all, you were the one who led me to the fire. The headline, which is all about Santorum's momentum, the headlines and the leads, it's all about the insurgency. If you report on an insurgency that's not going to ultimately surge anywhere and you know it, what's the point?
Well, you don't know it, Bob. I mean, you asked me what people think, and I said if you wake them up in the middle of the night, people are going to say Romney is going to win this election. But this is a daily newspaper, and so we're leading, as we should, with the news of the day, and this is unexpected news. I mean, if we took the perspective of counseling our readers not to pay attention to daily fluctuations in news, there wouldn't be newspapers because there wouldn't be anything to report.
You know, I read to you from page one above the fold of the Post. I should have turned inside to the A section where there's a story that I think is actually substantially more significant. It's about voter turnout at the primaries thus far that seem to bespeak a lack of enthusiasm among the GOP faithful voting poorly for whoever the candidate is. Should that story have been out on page one as well?
Well, I mean, the editors play the page one game every day, and then that very story you're talking about was played extremely prominently on the website, and a lot of folks were talking about it as a result of that. I mean, one thing with the transition from the paper to the web is that you see which story is really catching the interest of people based on the clicks.
Dana, thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Dana Milbank is a political columnist for The Washington Post.
In 2008, we spoke to The Nation's Washington editor, Chris Hayes, who was fresh off the campaign trail. He was tired, but he vowed to never again lose himself in campaign minutiae at the expense of the big picture. Hayes is now editor-at-large at The Nation and host of Up With Chris Hayes on MSNBC, a weekly show that covers a range of issues, including politics. We wondered, how's that vow holding up? Chris, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
So we spoke to you fresh off the campaign trail 4 years ago, and you were, shall we say, underwhelmed by the experience. You said...
Well, it's a combination of the superficiality born of time constraints and a lack of expertise by the people doing the coverage, combined with a herd mentality that is the inevitable result of the terror of being on the campaign trail.
That was harsh. I think that we in some ways have been rightly chastened by the experience of 2008. There were two huge predictive overreaches that happened in that campaign. One was all of the punditry and commentary that happened in the winter of 2007 before the Iowa votes had been cast that basically said Barack Obama is incapable of eating into Hillary Clinton's lead. Hillary Clinton is inevitable. And then after the stunning victory for Barack Obama in Iowa, there was a whole bevy of commentary about how he would roll through New Hampshire and sew up the nomination. And what happened was far more unpredictable and fascinating than either of those scenarios. And the experience of that, I think, has rightly chastened the press corps. The downside is that I think, and let me speak for myself here, the experience of 2008 has forced me to entertain more seriously what would seem inconceivable. For instance, Herman Cain as the next Republican nominee.
Why do you think it's evidence of being chastened that people are taking this endless run of candidates one after the other seriously based on results that have no predictive meaning?
There were a lot of people, let us remember, who thought it was preposterous and unserious for Barack Obama, the man with the name Barack Obama, to be running for president of the United States. The unlikeliness of that turn of events does have to factor into how you consider who is serious and who is not. So on one level, you don't want to be a gatekeeper. You don't want to tell people who should be considered serious and who isn't. At the same time, you don't want to indulge the worst aspects of the news cycle freak show trivenalia and spend tons of time talking about, say, Donald Trump.
I'm not saying that you should say Herman Cain isn't serious or Michelle Bachmann isn't serious. I simply think that these contests are blown out of proportion and they ought to be put in perspective along with the polls. I mean, the word momentum makes me want to tear the flesh from my face.
I feel the same way about the notion of momentum. And I think it's just hard when we don't have a ton of information other than these polls to figure out where voters' minds are at. And that's a basic problem of all political reporting everywhere.
Okay. So how do you cover something like Rick Santorum's recent caucus victories on Tuesday while also making it clear that actually they're not very consequential?
There's basically two ways I think we've approached this problem of covering the GOP race. One is to think of it as a sort of hermeneutic exercise in which it says something about that set of voters that in three different states, Rick Santorum won in the wake of a bunch of news about different social issues. That's one way, I think, to approach it. The other way is to use the opportunity of the campaign to talk about substance.
What you call the pivot technique?
Right. At a certain point, you feel like you're filling a news hole with no new information. It's become a way to deal with that fundamental problem. You know, I saw a bunch of stories in the wake of Mitt Romney's gaffe the morning after he won Florida when talking to Soledad O'Brien, in which he said he, quote, didn't care about poor people. I saw a bunch of people say, you know, he misspoke there, but what does the actual Romney tax plan and policy proposals do for poor people? That's a way of using the news cycle to talk about substance.
In the political coverage that you've provided so far, either as an editor at The Nation or as the host of this MSNBC show, what is the moment you are most proud of and what's the moment you're least proud of?
I do think that the campaign discussions we've had on the show have been either entertaining, because there's a certain water cooler quality to watching this all unfold, or illuminating. I think the harder thing to necessarily defend every decision on is how much time we have devoted to it at what stages. If I went back and you showed me, you know, while 200 people were getting killed by their government every day in Syria, you were talking about Herman Cain, that's a harder choice to defend based purely on news value.
So then what would you say to that political sage we spoke to back in 2008 who said,
I just think that there's too much quantity right now in political coverage.
I still agree. I mean, I still agree. But I do think there are increasingly ways to make lemonade out of the lemons. I think there are ways to approach covering the campaign that allow you to talk about genuinely fascinating, important, substantive issues amidst all the mishigas of the flavor of the week.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Hayes is an editor at large at The Nation and host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC.
The Super Bowl drew more than 100 million viewers last week, but as often happens, many of the most memorable moments weren't during gameplay. First, singer M.I.A. briefly flipped the bird to thousands of fans and everyone at home during the halftime show. I'ma say this once, yeah, I didn't give a NBC apologized. Then, after the game, Gisele Bündchen, supermodel wife of quarterback Tom Brady, was overheard using the F word on her way out of the stadium. She didn't apologize. For criminal lawyer Mary Prevost, the Super Bowl hijinks were a source of some satisfaction. In October 2010, one of her clients, an off-duty cop named Eric Holguin, went to a football game in San Diego where the hometown Chargers were playing against his beloved Arizona Cardinals. Holguin, sporting Cardinals colors, was repeatedly sworn at by Chargers fans, a pair of whom even attempted to pick a fight. Holguin said, "No thanks," punctuated with an expletive, the expletive, F-U. All three men were ejected from the game, but soon after, Holguin, who was waiting outside for his wife, was charged with resisting arrest and assault. Now he's suing the city of San Diego on grounds that the First Amendment protects his right to swear at other fans or anyone else. We're joined by his lawyer, Mary Prevost. Mary, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to tell you, Mary, I have a more than passing interest in this story. Mrs. Garfield is from a strange and distant land, and she has strange customs. And the first time I went to a baseball game with her, we were behind the home dugout, and she started screaming at the umpire, F the judge, which made me worry that she was going to be arrested.
Yeah.
Is there not case law that says that profanity is not necessarily protected speech in a public place?
No. What they can limit is bad behavior, assaultive behaviors. But as far as your speech goes, unless it's something that's likely to incite a riot, then they can't regulate it in a public forum.
Now, there is a Supreme Court case which gives an exemption to free speech for so-called fighting words.
Sure.
Profanity that is destined to result in fisticuffs. Tell me how the fighting words test applies to this case.
Well, it really doesn't, because what really incites violence may be words plus actions. Now, I would think if someone said something very personal about, say, your wife, that might be fighting words, and maybe that's not protected, but there are numerous court cases and law review articles that have pretty much said FU is just so common in our vernacular that it really doesn't mean anything anymore. It's not obscene. It's really not a fighting word.
Your client, Eric Holguin, he's an L.A. policeman. Have you asked him if he ever arrested anyone for disorderly conduct for using that expression at him?
I never have, but it would be an illegal arrest because you're allowed to say F you to a police officer on the street so long as you don't walk up and assault him.
Wait. I'm allowed to just willy-nilly walk up to a cop and say that phrase? Without fear of consequences?
Oh, I didn't say that you wouldn't get retaliated against by the officer. But if you're driving by and you see a police officer on the street, you can yell out, F you to him. There's nothing he can do about it.
At the Super Bowl a week ago, an entertainer, M.I.A., during the halftime show, flipped the bird at not only the assembled fans, but, you know, maybe a billion people around the world. Did you, by any chance, get up and do a jig at the delicious timeliness of this episode for your case?
You know, I was more excited when Gisele Bündchen used the F word. She was upset and was blaming, apparently, some of the receivers, and everybody heard that Gisele was using the F word, and it went viral, and I said, this is perfect for us.
What's going to happen?
The case law is really clear that you can't limit certain speech. It has to be, like you said, fighting words. So I think what will happen is eventually the city, if they're smart, will just settle the case. I'd love to go to trial on it, though. I would love to go to trial on it.
One more thing. If a person is arrested incorrectly under the law, and the arrest leads into a spiral of other unpleasant events that might include resisting arrest, assault and battery. Is the arrestee any less responsible for his conduct under a bad arrest than he would be under a good one?
Yeah, you have the absolute right to resist an unlawful arrest. So if whatever precipitated the arrest was wrongful to begin with, then what flows from there as far as charges go, generally speaking, should be thrown out.
So I'm safe to take my wife to a ball game again?
Well, now hold on. I didn't say that these stadiums are going to be following the law, right? Look what they did with Mr. Holguin. You know, you might tell your wife to settle down a little bit until we've got an absolute ruling from a federal court.
I got to tell you, that has not worked.
Well, then keep me on retainer, okay?
Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Prevost is a criminal defense attorney in San Diego, California.
Coming up, a new trend in online gaming, pacifism, and the 50th anniversary of Jackie's televised White House tour.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Oklahoma lawmaker William Forkiller introduced a bill this week that would impose a 1% tax on violent video games. The bill defines violent as any game that has received a rating of teen, mature, or adult only. But as Wall Street Journal reporter Connor Daugherty recently reported, a growing number of gamers who play these violent video games do so non-violently. Daugherty calls it virtual pacifism, essentially finding ways to play games that incorporate killing and maiming without engaging in either. Daugherty says that, according to legend, some players have managed to play the popular military shooter game Call of Duty without killing anyone.
I don't actually know if this is true, but I've heard rumors about a guy who went through the entire game with nothing but a shield. And there are other games, one was called Deus Ex, that are just all about shooting and mayhem and craziness, and people sort of sneak through them or they use sedative darts to get through them. There was one called Metal Gear Solid Guns of the Patriots, so guns is even in the title there. And that game, I think you got a bandana or something if you could complete it without killing anybody. When you complete this task, it goes bing, and this little icon pops up.
So in some places, designers are actually encouraging people to see if they can get through the game without violence.
It's that the game has sort of given them this choice. So, I mean, and I think it's probably the designer signaling to them that they should or could or should try this.
You also suggested that YouTube has played a role in some of
this. Huge role. And when I talk to these people, they're very conscious of how many hits their YouTube channel has received from other gamers, sort of. And, you know, when I was talking to this one guy, he kept saying to me, well, it was something nobody had really done before. And I, some more I thought about it, I was like, you know, he's playing this. It's a single-player adventure game that this guy was playing. He was playing Skyrim. So a lot of it is sort of the solitary pursuit. So when he's saying nobody's really done it before, he's talking about this whole internet community.
And how does he know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, because he's gone YouTube checking out what other people have done. He's probably reading blogs. People want to sort of memorialize their experience in the game and sort of show that they did it another way.
It seems to me that you could only do this in a single-player game like Skyrim. But a lot of these games happen online with people playing against actual other people who may want to virtually hurt you. So are there online gaming pacifists?
Well, Brock, this kid I met for my story, he was doing that. And his compatriots would get very upset with him for going about things that way. The thing I think is kind of interesting about it is, video games don't really have any rules. I mean, what are the rules? The rules are what's in that box, and nobody really knows what they are until they've tried to bend them every which way they can.
reading some of the critics of video games, you hear the assumption that gamers have to play within the game designer's constraints. A shoot-'em-up game is going to require a degree of shooting them up. But the existence of virtual pacifism seems to point to a kind of non-obedience.
Presumably, the designers are very conscious of the idea that they want to give their players as many different routes through as they can. And, you know, it's funny, I was talking to the director of Skyrim. I asked him, well, are you surprised that, you know, people would play this without killing? He's like, no, you know, the whole point of the game is to have immense choice, and we sort of anticipated people would do that. But what he said was the thing that surprised him the most is that some people started discovering that you could put buckets on people's head and it would make them unable to see, and then you could just rob them blind with no recourse, you know? And he said that was the thing that surprised him, that players were discovering the artificial intelligence could just be blocked out with a simple bucket over a guy's head. So, but the point is that there's so many things that lie undiscovered in these games. And if you give people that much choice, they're probably going to end up surprising you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Connor Daugherty reports for The Wall Street Journal. He mentioned that virtual pacifists upload videos of their game experiences to YouTube to show off their skills. You're hearing one of these videos now, with appropriate scoring added after the fact. This video was posted by 16-year-old gamer Brock Soischer, who's playing a game called Battlefield 3. But he's not responsible for any of the gunshots, explosions, or sundry mayhem you're hearing. Instead, his avatar is running around the battlefield with a defibrillator, reviving fallen soldiers amidst the carnage.
When someone gets killed in that game, if they're your ally, what you're able to do with the medic class is that you're able to take out a defibrillator, go over to them, and by just simply hitting R1, you shock them and it'll bring them back to life. And so instead of killing people, I would go around and throwing down health kits, which heals people, and reviving people if they die.
That's built into the game, so I assume that's not that unusual.
Well, yes, it's built into the game, but you don't really see people running around only doing that. It's kind of something for the side.
So when you're doing this online, you are potentially messing up your teammates, right? Because you're not killing anybody. Do they get mad at you?
Some of them do and some of them don't. There was one guy who was yelling at me for quite a while and asking why I wouldn't kill anyone. I don't really know if the listeners really want to hear exactly what he said, but he generally said that I was a bad person because I should be helping out the team more. I do kind of feel bad because it is obviously breaking the game.
I can't believe you would feel even the slightest bit bad about that. I mean, it's not like you're hurting anybody.
Well, okay, well, that was a bit of a pun.
Do you have a favorite non-kill moment?
Yeah, actually, that would be in one of my other favorite games, Uncharted 3, where that also has multiplayer, but like, obviously the point of the match is to kill people, but there is no type of healing or anything like that, so literally the whole video is just me hiding from the guys, and so with Battlefield 3, it was great because I could actually heal people, and when I finished Uncharted 3 that round, I ended up with, you know, completely 0 points because I didn't do a thing. But in Battlefield 3, even though all these people, you know, they're trying as hard as they can to kill people, by not killing a single person, I actually came in first place in the match. And I thought that was actually really cool.
Wow. Thanks, Brock.
Oh, yeah, anytime. Thank you for having me.
Brock Soischer, 16-year-old pacifist gamer. You can check out his videos at BrockyBoy00.
Simply not a more congenial spot for happily ever aftering than here in Camelot.
To Tuesday is Valentine's Day, and 50 Valentine's days ago, the First Lady offered the nation a box of chocolates in the form of a televised tour of the White House. All three networks were there when Jacqueline Kennedy invited America to come in, and America collectively replied, "Don't mind if we do." WNYC's Sarah Fishko brings it back.
It was a television program no one really wanted to make. But on Valentine's Day, 1962, at 10 p.m., 56 million people gathered around their TV sets to watch it.
This is the White House, as seen from its south lawn. For the next hour, Mrs. John F. Kennedy invites you to visit the president's house and see some of the restorations she's made in its interior.
CBS's Charles Collingwood escorted the First Lady around as she told the history of the White House and explained her approach. And audiences were transfixed.
Before we look at any of the changes you've made, what's your basic plan?
Well, I really don't have one, because I think this house will always grow and should. It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house, hardly anything before 1902.
Jackie, 31 when she'd arrived in Washington, had been given her own tour of the White House by Mamie Eisenhower and had had a few comments to make, says broadcast historian Marianne Watson.
She said that she thought the White House looked like a hotel that had been furnished by a January clearance sale furniture store.
So the new First Lady made this redo her project. She raised the money herself from private funders.
They had a fine arts committee, she had a curator, and they had a $2 million budget.
But in the beginning, nobody had been thinking about TV, least of all Jacqueline Kennedy, who'd really wanted a coffee table book to document the work she'd done. And certainly not CBS Television's head of investigative documentaries at the time, Perry Wolfe, who was assigned the job of producing the program.
It was Vietnam War time, and I wanted to go to, I wanted to go to Vietnam. I kept saying, this is the kind of thing you read in the dentist's office on the National Geographic. I mean, a tour of the White House. And on the other hand, I was wrong.
JFK was a great appreciator of the power of television. So when the subject of a TV show came up, Jack Kennedy convinced Jackie Kennedy it was a good idea. CBS began months of pre-production with the director Franklin Schaffner and producer Wolf.
But we could not have direct contact with Mrs. Kennedy. We had to work through her press agent.
So they all met for the first time on the day of the taping, January 15th. They had no idea what to expect. She might need a teleprompter. She might need a script.
But she didn't need it. She showed up ready to go.
Have you made any good finds lately?
Well, we have. This chest is rather interesting. As you know, the thing we care about most is something that belonged to a past president. This little chest was left by President Van Buren to his grandson.
And the way it worked was we would go to a room and sort of talk it over, and she would tell us what she wanted to do, and then we'd shoot it. And then the next room.
What is the diplomatic reception room used for besides receiving diplomats?
Well, it's the room that people see first when they come to the White House. Everyone who comes to a state dinner.
Even as she was gliding through the long taping day, Perry Wolfe remembers she was nervous.
There was a bench with wonderful silk covering that had come from France, and she was a smoker, and she put the cigarette out on the fabric and not in the ashtray. She missed the ashtray.
Nevertheless, she took charge and pretty much hosted the whole hour. Our correspondent was in the background.
There's nothing more than cues for her to speak. And now, Mrs. Kennedy, can we go to the next room? That sort of thing.
This is the part of the White House where you have the musical affairs.
That's right. This piano was designed by Franklin Roosevelt with the Eagle support. And this is the end of the room where Pablo Casals played for us.
Of course, she was not a professional. You know, her voice was a little constricted.
I just think that everything in the White House should be the best.
It was not her normal speaking voice, but that's where the tension was shown, but not that much.
That's the oldest thing in the White House.
It was astonishing how much she knew.
You should look at this pier table. It's Empire, and it belonged to Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's brother, who came here after Waterloo. He lived in Bordentown, New Jersey.
From 11 to 7, the big TV cameras on wheels followed Mrs. Kennedy around as she spun out her well-learned historical facts.
And here Jefferson gave his famous dinners and introduced such exotic foods as macaroni, waffles, and ice cream to the United States.
So we were just... Well, we were taken by her personality, as the whole world was, of course.
I don't think the solution should be to deny medical care to
that same
people,
day,
however,
President Kennedy was holding a press conference.
I would suggest that the best remedy would be...
So he came over when he finished and taped a few words for the end of the broadcast. But he was still in press conference mode.
That evening, CBS played the unedited tapes for the president and the first lady, and he wasn't happy with his performance.
He said, no, I've got to do it again, Mr. Wolf. I've got to do it again. So he came back the next morning.
It's a sign of the times that this situation caused a bit of a broadcast backup.
The cameras were due to go to Ohio for the Pillsbury bake-off. And, you know, the plane was standing by and they were standing by. And I don't know what happened to the Pillsbury bake-off, but the President of the United States did his retake.
Well, I think the great effort that she's made has been to bring us much more intimately in contact with all the men who lived here.
So on February 14th, CBS and NBC ran the program simultaneously without commercials. And a few days later, ABC ran it. It was the most watched television program ever at that time. Tens of millions of people tuned in.
You know, it wasn't their curious interest in the history of the White House, but it was a curious interest in Jackie Kennedy.
Mrs. Kennedy won a special Emmy Award for the broadcast, and the president maintained his interest in the power of TV.
As a matter of fact, he called the next day after the CBS and NBC broadcast, he called the chairman of the FCC. He called Newton Minow.
He called me and he said, what was the rating? I said, I'll find out. And I called Frank Stanton, who was the president of CBS. I said, I got to know something right away. He called me back and I called the president. He said, well, what was the answer? And I said, Mr. President, Jackie's rating was higher than your press conference.
Thank you, Mr. President. And thank you, Mrs. Kennedy, for showing us this wonderful house in which you live.
So, with this particular Valentine's Day special that night in 62, America was well into its love affair. Not with the house, not even with the husband, but with the host. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
Made the wrong turn somewhere. Now, I'm trying to find the bedroom. I just came out of the John Hancock bathroom where I was taking a shower in the Alexander Hamilton bathtub. And I think
the carpenters and painters here have been just working like beavers around the clock. We hope to have it finished
in May. Which way is she? The bedroom. The bedroom is where?
Actually, the original schedule didn't call for it to be completed until July, but the work has gone well.
I should like to point out that I am I am standing here in my shorts, dripping wet. Now I've got an important conference in 15 minutes. So I must be dressed in 10 minutes, which means I shall have to move ahead toward our bedroom with great vigor.
Excuse me, Charles. Dear, go down this hall to the Andrew Jackson smoking room, then turn right into the President Taft rumpus room, across over through the Woodrow Wilson ping pong room, then left at the Dolly Madison pinochle room, through the President Grant drinking room, past the Richard Nixon dumbwaiter. And that's our room.
Well, let's see. Now I go past the Dolly Madison ping pong room, across the Richard Nixon, the drinking room, and then I go left at the Andrew Jackson room.
Wasn't that your husband?
Yes, it was.
He's a magnificent looking man.
Yes. And we decided to leave him just the way he was originally.
That was a clip from Vaughn Meter's historic comedy album, The First Family.
That's it for this week's show. On the Medium was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.